It's been said that success breeds success. And if there's any truth to that statement, then Gideon is an exception to the rule. Irving Berlin said this about success. The toughest thing about success is that you have to keep being a success. And in our passage this morning, as we read about the aftermath of this great victory that God gave to Gideon and to Israel, that success didn't do Gideon much good. It didn't do Gideon much good. He did not finish well. And it brings up somewhat of a catch-22 in the life of faith, or in the Christian life. That is, that God wants to bless us with success. But so often, when we are blessed with success, we tend to forget God. And that seems to be what's happening here with Gideon. Gideon seems to be a man that is spoiled by the great success that God had given him. Now, we left Gideon last week enjoying arguably the greatest moment of his life. I mean, pulling off one of the most incredible military victories in history. I mean, look, Gideon went against an army, an opposing force of over 100,000 soldiers with only 300 men of his own, with clay pots, torches, and trumpets. It doesn't even mention that they had any swords. So Gideon, with his 300 unarmed or lightly armed men, he conquered a force of over 100,000 through the power and the action of the Lord. Now, even more amazing than that, we don't even have any casualties recorded on the Israelite side through this whole skirmish, through this whole event. I mean, this is the absolute pinnacle of Gideon's career. Solidifies his reputation, cements him in the history of God's people. But as we read on in chapter 8, we see that the thrill of victory is not equally shared by everybody in Israel. Immediately in chapter 8, we read about two acts of insubordination after the initial rout of the Midianite horde. First, you have the incident with Ephraim. Now, Ephraim, you have to understand, was a proud and powerful tribe. It had a very extensive territory as the territories of the tribes went. The tribe of Ephraim boasted the great leader Joshua, who had led Israel into the promised land after Moses had died. And for those of you who remember the book of Joshua, that was just one victory after another. The future seemed bright. Joshua did a wonderful job as leader and situated Israel, God's people, in the best possible position by the time he had died. Ephraim also boasted the tabernacle of all the 12 tribes of Israel. You know, the worship place, the most holy place, the tabernacle was within Ephraim's borders in the city of Shiloh. And so they, at the beginning of this chapter, confront Gideon and they voice their displeasure in not being included in the battle. As though this were not God's will, that this was Gideon's decision. So they feel slighted and they feel offended. And it says they criticize Gideon sharply. And so because Gideon is God's chosen leader, God's chosen judge, God's chosen deliverer to rescue his people, this should be seen for what it is, an act of insubordination. The second one is this kind of double incident with Succoth and Peniel. These were two towns that refused also to recognize Gideon's leadership and his authority. They choose, when Gideon and his 300 men are pursuing the Midianite hordes, the Midianite remnants of their army out of the land, they choose not to lend support to Gideon's soldiers. Now, there are many reasons why they may have refused. Being closer to the border of the land, perhaps they were fearing reprisal from whatever remnants of the Midianite army there would be. They were not wiped out yet. Perhaps they were looking at this as the most prudent course of action with regard to their own security as towns. And so they deny help to Gideon and his pursuing soldiers. And so again, I mention those two things because though they are different in nature, those are both acts of insubordination. The difference is how Gideon deals with these acts of insubordination. The reason why I bring this up is because some argue that already here in the opening verses of chapter 8 that Gideon is already diverging from God's will and God's purposes. Now, by the end of the chapter, we have to admit that Gideon has completely diverted. Gideon has forgotten about God. But even here, we see the seeds of that rebellion in Gideon's heart, so some would argue. But look at how Gideon responds in each situation. With Ephraim, this powerful tribe, this politically strong tribe, this very significant tribe with regards to both the society and the culture and also the religion of Israel, Gideon uses flattery and persuasion. He says, "What have I accomplished compared to you? Aren't the gleanings of Ephraim's grapes better than the full grape harvest of Abiezer? God gave Oreb and Zeb, the Midianite leaders, into your hands. What was I able to do compared to you?" And of course, it worked. At this, their resentment subsided. Their anger at him resided. With Succoth and Peniel, Gideon's response was completely different. Their insubordination was of a different sort. It was more cowardly than heroic. But Gideon responds to these two towns with harshness and with torture of their leaders and also with destruction of the tower at Peniel. He deals with Succoth and Peniel as outright traitors, aiding and abetting the enemy Midianites. Verses 7 and 9 record this. Gideon replied to the officials of Succoth, "Just for that, when the Lord has given Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, I will tear your flesh with desert thorns and briars." And then verse 9, he said to the men of Peniel, "When I return in triumph, I will tear down this tower." The reason I think that this is so much in question is that Gideon does not consult God in either one of these instances. These seem like very, very significant courses of action with very, very significant implications. And yet Gideon is not going to God for direction. He's not going to God for guidance. He seems to be falling into the trap that we've seen throughout the study of Judges. He seems to be doing just what he feels like. He seems to be doing what is right in his own eyes. I mean, remember in chapter 6, for those of you who are here, when God called Gideon was going back to God for everything, every reassurance that God would give him. He was just making sure every step of the way, is this what your will is, God? Please show me clearly that this is your will. Please just make it extremely crystal clear every single step. And now he doesn't go to God at all. He seems to be operating less out of that wisdom and humility and more out of political savvy. Ephraim is a tribe that needed to be dealt with kid's gloves. He needed Ephraim to be on his side, whereas Succoth and Peniel were less important. And so they were ripe to make an example out of. Having achieved a measure of victory and a measure of success, and wanting to hold on to that victory and success on his own terms, he seems to forget God. But there's a third act of insubordination recorded in this chapter too, I found interesting. And this act of insubordination comes from his own son. Verses 18 to 21, he asked Zeba and Zalmunna, "What kind of men did you kill at Tabor?" "Men like you," they answered, "each one bearing with the bearing of a prince." Gideon replied, "Those were my brothers, the sons of my own mother. As surely as the Lord lives, if you had spared their lives, I would not kill you." Turning to Jether, his oldest son, he said, "Kill them." But Jether did not draw his sword because he was only a boy and was afraid. Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Come, do it yourself. As is the man, so is his strength." So Gideon stepped forward and killed them. Now, this little passage explains a couple of things to us. First of all, you remember when we encountered Gideon in chapter 6, and he was threshing grain in a wine press, which we talked about was extremely odd, seemed like a very illogical and we concluded very cowardly thing to do, because he was afraid of the Midianites. He was threshing his grain in such a way that no one would be able to see him and give him trouble. And perhaps this gives us the reason why. When he asked Zeba and Zalmunna who they had killed at Tabor, they said, "Well, men like you." And Gideon replied, "Those were my brothers, the sons of my own mother." So perhaps Gideon's initial cowardice was well-founded. Perhaps he had lost a great deal of his family to the Midianites. So that's one thing. But why did Gideon try and put this execution off on his son? I was thinking about that this week. Now, perhaps Gideon did not want this to be perceived by the people of Israel as revenge. Perhaps he felt that this would have undermined his even-handedness as a judge. I suspect that revenge had something to do with this once he found out that Zeba and Zalmunna had been the one who killed off some of his family. But Gideon did not want it to be perceived that way, so he pawned it off on his son. That's one option. That's one way to look at this. But here's another. I think that this one is perhaps even more persuasive based on where this chapter goes. Perhaps already here, Gideon was thinking about a leadership dynasty in Israel. He wanted his son to be involved in this victory, this execution of the enemy leaders, because that would solidify a future not only for him, but also for his son. But here's what we should ask. Is this God's will? Again, this is a significant course of action. Again, Gideon makes this comment that, well, if you hadn't killed my brothers, then I would have spared your lives. And then you have this whole thing with his son. And then Gideon does end up slaughtering or executing Zeba and Zalmunna. But is this God's will? We don't know, because Gideon is not going to God for guidance and direction. So is this God's will, or has Gideon already gone completely off the reservation? Well, what follows is something a bit encouraging anyway. The Israelites try to persuade Gideon to rule over them, and they try and persuade him not just that, but they want to set him up as somewhat of a king and establish that family dynasty that perhaps Gideon is already thinking about. And to his credit, Gideon refuses, in word anyway. So at this point, he's still at least paying lip service to God. See that in verse 23, Gideon told them, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." He says all the right things. But then we come to this perplexing thing in verse 24, where he says, "I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring from your share of the plunder." Gideon levies this tax and commissions the creation of an ephod. Now, for those of you who don't remember the Old Testament in the Torah, the ephod was a priestly garment, and it was to be worn by only Levites that were serving in the tabernacle. Exodus 28 describes this in much detail if you're curious about looking that up later. But it was this sleeveless outer garment in two pieces, one front piece, one rear piece, and it would have been fine purple cloth, and it would have been gold with precious stones inset on it. There were 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel, and there was some kind of a pocket in the front of this ephod that contained the Urim and Thummim. And these were some kind of objects that were to be used by the priest in discerning God's will for the people, which is extremely ironic based on Gideon's seeming trajectory, because he doesn't seem to be consulting with God at all anymore. But I want you to understand that in commissioning this ephod, Gideon is taking on privileges to himself that were inappropriate. The ephod belonged with the priests serving the tabernacle. Gideon has this ephod made and puts it in his own hometown as some kind of a symbol of his victory, a symbol of his leadership. But in taking on these privileges that are not appropriate for him, he directs attention away from God and directs attention to himself. And so we have this man who began his career exercising leadership in such a way that it honored God and it was serving his fellow people, serving God's people. And now it seems that he's using God's victory through him over the Midianites to bless himself with wealth, with status, with reputation, with position. So we see how this story serves as a warning about the dangers of success. And let's consider the warning signs that we see here in this chapter. First, I've been mentioning this right along, I think it's the most glaring difference between the Gideon of chapter 8 and the Gideon of chapter 6, that Gideon becomes a man of infrequent prayer. Gideon is not looking to God for guidance after this huge victory over the Midianites. When he was weak, when he was the least of his family, which was the least of its clan, which was the least of its tribe, Gideon constantly went to God with prayer and petition, seeking God's will every single step of the way, in every situation. How exactly do you want me to do this, God? But this posture is completely absent in Gideon's life after victory. Prayerlessness, whether it's for Gideon or whether it's for us, always reveals that we are working independently of God. In fact, Gideon doesn't seem to be taking any counsel from anyone at all. It doesn't say anything about Gideon consulting the leaders of the tribes, his generals, his family. He's not consulting with anyone. Again, proof that Gideon is falling into this trap of doing what is right in his own eyes. And his success, like anyone's success that is perceived as independent from God or others, ends in isolation. Proverbs 18 talks about that right at the beginning. An unfriendly man pursues selfish ends. He defies all sound judgment. A fool finds no pleasure in understanding, but delights in airing his own opinions. When you don't allow a faith community to speak into your life and your situation, you will always become corrupted in your thinking and your behavior. The second thing I notice about Gideon, especially as he deals with not only his enemies, but also the two towns of Succoth and Peniel, is that he has this resentment, or he has this bitterness about anyone who goes against him in any way. When it becomes all about you, you naturally resent those who get in your way. And resentment creates in you a harsh and unforgiving and cruel spirit. Now, I say that just because of how I read chapter 8. But again, you could argue that Gideon is still doing God's work at the beginning of chapter 8. It doesn't say that he is. It doesn't say that he's not. This is where it gets complicated. This is where we have to use our own interpretation somewhat. Maybe it was perfectly in line with God's will that Ephraim would be flattered and that Gideon would build bridges there, and that Succoth and Peniel would be punished very severely to be an example of what not standing with God and his people would result in. But Gideon is not taking counsel from God. He's not taking counsel from others. And the situation just gets messier and messier. The third thing we see toward the end of the chapter is this material excess and the preservation of Gideon's reputation. Gideon takes gold from the people ultimately to honor himself. He proves that he's no longer leveraging this victory that God blessed him with to glorify God and serve the people, but he is using this to solidify his own leadership in Israel. Gideon is looking after himself and trying to, I suppose, cement a prosperous future. Now, Gideon, possibly from the very moment of his victory over the Midianites, seems to be planning the establishment of his own empire with himself at the center. When we build our own empires, we can't take criticism. We can't take counsel from others that goes against what we think is best for ourselves. This is the sad thing about Gideon's life, and this is the warning to us. See, most Christians will pass the adversity test when we feel helpless, when we're in a bind. We pass the test of adversity because that reminds us of our complete dependence on God and the grace of God. Many Christians, when they fail the test of prosperity. Because when we're prosperous, when we're successful, when we're victorious, even if that was initially a gift from God, once we're there, once we've got it, really, who needs God's grace? We've got everything we want. So when Gideon was small and weak and insignificant, he naturally depended on God for everything. But when success brought him the praise of men, Gideon forgot about God and made it all about himself. So the lesson here is beware your strengths, not your weaknesses. Beware your successes, not your failures. As the chapter concludes, we have a single glimpse of something positive in verse 28, where it says, Midian was subdued before the Israelites and did not raise its head again. During Gideon's lifetime, the land enjoyed peace for 40 years. Seems okay, but things really aren't okay because it goes on in verse 29 and following. Gideon went back home to live. He had 70 sons of his own, for he had many wives. His concubine who lived in Shechem also bore him a son, whom he named Abimelech. So Gideon goes to living a life of ease. He goes to living a life of excess. He goes to living a life of immorality. Many wives, many concubines. And then this son that Gideon has, this one of his 70 sons that Gideon has from his concubine that he names Abimelech, is very telling because Abimelech means my father is king. In the naming of his son, Gideon reveals his intentions. Gideon reveals his motivations. Gideon reveals his trajectory. Gideon reveals what he is doing with this success that God had blessed him with. Although he wouldn't stand up and say, yes, I am king, because that would have gone completely against God and been suspect to the people, he, in essence, has taken on a kingship that was not his to take on. And it completely contradicts what he said earlier when he said, I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. Gideon's son, Abimelech, by the way, becomes a mass murderer in his desire to carry on his father's unofficial kingship. And then it says, there was peace in the land for 40 years. Now it's interesting, this 40-year peace in the land thing repeats itself somewhat. After the judge Othniel, the land had peace for 40 years. After Deborah, the land had peace for 40 years. After Gideon, the land has peace for 40 years. What is that about? Well, I think this actually highlights another discouraging theme that we haven't talked much about yet in Judges. Somehow there's this disconnect. Somehow there is this failure to pass down faith from one generation to another. It happens here. It happens throughout the book of Judges. It's just another devastating and destructive aspect of this vicious cycle and this downward spiral. You know that I was looking through Judges, and I did it somewhat quickly toward the end of the week this week, but this is the last time, I believe, in the book of Judges where it is said that the land experienced peace after the reign of a judge. So with these judges, with these redeemers, with these small-ass saviors, things get better for a little while, but then they get even worse than they were before. Now, it's been said that the true test of leadership comes when the leader moves on, the aftermath. It says, no sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals. They set up Baal Berith as their god, did not remember the Lord their God who had rescued them from the hands of all their enemies. They also failed to show kindness to the family of Gideon for all the good things he had done for them. Having started so well, Gideon finishes poorly. External threats change with each new generation. We see that today. We see that in the book of the Judges. We've already encountered the Moabites. We've encountered the Canaanites, the Midianites, Philistines. The external threats change with every new generation, but the internal threat stays the same. God's people constantly, constantly pursuing alternatives to God. That leads to destruction in their own lives, and it creates role models that cannot genuinely pass down faith to the next generation, because regardless of what one generation says, the next generation looks at what the previous generation does. It's a warning. It's a warning that we have here. And the story of Gideon contains a warning. It contains an encouragement too. The encouragement we've dealt with the last couple of weeks, that God can take the most insignificant person, that God can raise up whoever he wants to do his work and to accomplish amazing things in this world and in his kingdom. He can give us great victories through the most unlikely of people. Maybe me, maybe you, it doesn't matter. Whoever is willing, God will work through. That's the encouragement. But the warning is this: to those to whom God has given success, we have to beware of the complacency and the corrupting influence of that God-given success. I mean, look at how Gideon has changed since we first met him as a humble young man. When the angel of the Lord appeared to him, he built an altar to God. After his victory, he's not building any altars. He's building an ephod that becomes an idol to the people. His first test from God was to be an idol breaker. He went to his father's house, his father's property. He tore down the altar to Baal. He pulled down the Asherah pole. Here, he becomes an idol maker in the commissioning of this ephod, which represents his leadership. At first, Gideon went to the Lord constantly for reassurance and guidance. Here, though at least for a time in chapter 8, he continues to do things in God's name, he doesn't consult God once. Gideon experienced an amazing victory through the power of God, but he did not let that victory shape the rest of his life. Did he fail to trust God after the victory? Is that the problem? Or having experienced that success, was it more important to him to chart his own course than to risk what God may have asked of him next? In closing today, I just want to share with you the importance of finishing strong. It's been something that I've been thinking about quite a bit lately. I brought it up at the Elder Deacon retreat last weekend. I used this passage for devotions on Monday night at the council meeting as well. But 2 Timothy 4, verses 6 to 8, let me read this to you. This is Paul sharing with his servant Timothy. "For I am already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time has come for my departure. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing." Brothers and sisters, Gideon's victory over the Midianites pales in comparison to the victory that we have in Jesus Christ. The victory of Jesus Christ on the cross is the greatest and most significant victory in the history of the universe. Christ's victory over sin and death that he shares with all who believe in him. Now, Paul understood that not just intellectually, but in a way that shaped everything about him. See, that's where Gideon falls down. That's where Gideon finishes poorly. He didn't let God's work and God's victory through him to shape everything else about his life. So that is my prayer as we go out from this place today, that we will be mindful of finishing strong, that we will always consult with the Lord every step of the way so that we don't get off track. Because God desires more than anything to do great things through us. Amen. Let's pray.